From the Sky News Centre at 5, an investigation has begun into a house fire which has killed three young children and left their mother seriously ill. Neighbours tried in vain to revive the two boys and girl after their lifeless bodies were pulled from the burning building in Bridlington in East Yorkshire shortly after midnight. One of them, Leslie Salisbury, is a nurse.
All I can remember is father bringing the little boy out. And I can't remember an awful lot more, but they actually told me that I worked on him for about an hour. And that is something I'll never forget his face.
The man suspected of throwing a fire extinguisher from a roof in London during Wednesday's student protest has been arrested. The 23-year-old was detained in Cambridgeshire. Police say overall 54 people were arrested following the violent demonstrations around Millbank. Around 8 million British Gas customers will face higher costs from next month. Household bills for gas and electricity will increase by an average of 7% from December the 10th. The company says rising wholesale prices forced the rise, but Adam Scorer from the watchdog Consumer Focus isn't convinced by that argument.
It does seem that when there's a little upward pressure on the wholesale price of gas, the companies are a bit like a coiled spring. They're ready to leap into action and get all their systems in place to raise prices, but 2 years of suppressed, deflated wholesale prices, and we saw very little action.
Police are hunting robbers who threatened a shopkeeper and his 15-month-old daughter with a gun and a meat cleaver. CCTV footage shows the two masked men in the shop in Prestwich on Tuesday. It's down to a shortlist of two as to who will take over the Olympic Stadium once the London 2012 Games are finished. West Ham and Tottenham will now enter into negotiations with the company in charge of the venue. And The Simpsons still have plenty more adventures to go on. Fox says it's backing the show for a 23rd season. It's already the longest running comedy show on US television. It started way back in 1989. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
BCFM Travel News, in association with the Global Traffic Network, supported by the Highways Agency.
In Gloucestershire, there's an accident on the A417 between the Airballoon roundabout and Cirencester. We have delays, particularly if you're going south from the Airballoon roundabout towards Cirencester. Also, the A46 near Tormartin, there's been an accident just north of Bath. It's between Dirham Park and the M4 Junction 18 roundabout. Number of vehicles involved and traffic is queuing in both directions. M4 going west past Bristol, beware of queuing traffic between junctions 19 and 20, the M32 and the M5 interchange. And we're just getting reports of an accident on the eastbound M4 going past Bristol around junctions 20 to 19. That's the M5 towards the M32. M32 coming out of Bristol is queuing from junction 1 at Hambrook towards the M4 roundabout. And the M5 going south from Bristol into Somerset is slow between the Avonmouth Bridge and Clevedon, junctions 18 to 20. In Wiltshire, beware of delays in both directions on the A303 around Amesbury. And in Dorset, the westbound side of the Ferndown Bypass, the A31, is heavy approaching the Camford Bottom roundabout. I'm Chris Wood.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Hello and welcome to BCFM's politics show. That's Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, and I'm joined this week by a leader of the Labour Group and councillor for Whitchurch, Bristol City Council, Helen Holland. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, two local students who were on Wednesday's demonstration in London against the tuition fees are here, and we ask them how they think higher education should be paid for. Two empty shops in Stokes Croft are falling down after being left derelict by a Hong Kong owner for decades. Bristol City Council even tried to compulsorily purchase them. But now they've been taken over by activists, and one has been turned into a free shop, popular with young mums and others on the poverty line. And charities are referring their most needy clients there. So why are the Classics Free Shop and the next door Emporium Art Gallery facing eviction? And news this week of two separate so-called terror plots in the UK from 5 and 7 years ago that appear this week to have been nothing of the sort, despite attention-grabbing and frightening headlines whirling their way around the world. Plus, we hear from author, former US Department of Justice War Crimes Special Investigator and former First Lieutenant in the US Army, John Loftus, about US links to funding and laundering money for the Nazis. That's in the second hour. On to our review of this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, some light rain continuing. Temperatures this weekend, highs of 11 degrees Celsius. A fairly dry weekend with some sunny spells, although fairly windy on Saturday. But it looks like no rain Saturday and Sunday. Next week, highs of 11 Celsius again and a fairly dry week with plenty of sunny spells. Next weekend, that's the 20th and 21st of November, highs of 6 degrees Celsius, ooh, pretty cold, and fairly dry, with some sunny spells. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests now, and let's start with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin.
Hello there.
Now, this week we hear that David Cameron is warning the G20 summit not to repeat the mistakes that led to the 1930 depression. Of course, Cameron and his business entourage are over in China at the moment, or have been during the week, and are now at the G20 summit. So what is the point of David Cameron warning the G20 summit not to repeat the mistakes that led to the 1930s depression?
Well, it's a bit odd, really, isn't it? Because we've already made those mistakes. That's why we're in the mess we're in. What he is referring to is the problems with competitive devaluation, which added particularly to the woes in the 1930s. I mean, the stock market collapsed in 1929. Countries basically then pursued selfish, individualistic policies, which, of course, if everybody behaves individualistically and selfishly, it tends to make the collective outcome worse. So he's hinting that that's the problem, which, of course, it is at this stage of the game. But, of course, the real problem is that we've got in the mess in the first place.
Well, the Prime Minister also said that one of the key factors behind the 2008 financial crisis, the build-up of massive trade imbalances between the high-consuming West and the productive economies of East Asia, had not gone away and might even, according to the IMF, be getting worse.
Yes, well, the Chinese see this as a bit of a joke, really. We're so successful, and therefore we're a problem for you. Their take on all of this is that they're worried about the quantitative easing that Ben Bernanke at the Federal Reserve is just about to inject into the system, because the effect of that is to push down the dollar. Now, that may sound like a bad thing, but actually, if you're exporting from the US, pushing down the dollar gives you a competitive edge. But of course, if everybody starts pursuing policies like that, basically manipulating their currencies in order to help their own internal problems, then we are in a situation where trade wars, protectionism, and so on could break out. You know, there is a danger of that, but the Chinese say, well, it's you, you're the one who's pressing the button on quantitative easing, not us. So it's you that's manipulating your currency. We're just trying to protect ourselves from the consequences.
David Cameron also said it was up to the heads of major economic powers gathered in the South Korean capital to show that this world, these politicians, these leaders have learned the lessons of the 1930s. We're going to keep the system open rather than see it progressively close. Now, what does he mean by opening and closing the system?
Well, if countries feel that their national interests are not being properly looked after, then they start to pursue policies which are in their interests, but possibly against the interests of their neighbours. Competitive devaluation, we've already mentioned, that's one of the main problems. In the 1930s, basically trade blocs formed. There was a trade bloc around Germany, a trade bloc around Japan, a trade bloc around the British Empire, a trade bloc around the United States. And these trade blocs ultimately went to war with each other. And this is the danger in a situation like this, is because the mainstream capitalist system, if you like, the globalised system, has become dysfunctional, everybody starts to pursue beggar my neighbour policies, looking after number one. But of course, in the end, that leads to conflict of all kinds.
Isn't there a certain inevitability to that?
I think there is, yes.
How might that manifest itself? Is that the sort of quantitative easing that's been going on?
Well,
in the
quantitative easing,
because the Chinese are pretty upset about that.
They are. The Chinese see that that's a manipulation of the US currency, and they rather resent being told by the US to stop manipulating their currency when the US is blatantly manipulating its currency and has done for years. I mean, let's face it: the biggest currency manipulators on the planet have always been the United States of America. The dollar is the world's reserve currency. It was linked to gold until 1971, and then in order to fight the Vietnam War, because they couldn't really afford it, the US took the dollar off gold, and the dollar has been basically a floating currency ever since. But that's a manipulation. It's basically manipulating your role as the currency provider for the system to get a free ride. And the US has had a free ride since 1971, so it's a bit cheeky of them to start accusing other people of manipulating their currency.
There's been calls in the newspapers this week, at least one article I saw, very strongly arguing for a return to the gold standard. What does that actually mean, and is it a good idea?
I don't think a return to the gold standard is a good idea, because it's too deflationary.
But something's got to back this money, hasn't it? I mean, one of the things we've been seeing over the last few years is that actually the money that we've got seems to be very, very backed by a rather sort of flaky, fingers-crossed approach. Well, surely you need some sort of solid commodity to back it up.
Not necessarily. What you need is fiscal responsibility to back it up.
The
dollar in theory could have been exchanged into gold before 1971, but in actual fact it couldn't be. But the point is that up to that point there was a degree of fiscal responsibility being shown by the United States as the main guarantors of the system. But what the United States has done since, under Democrat and Republican administrations, is basically abuse their position as the providers of currency of last resort to make other people pay for their mistakes. And that has eventually reached the point where everybody else is fed up with them. It's not just the Chinese, the Germans were reading the Riot Act to the Americans at the G20 summit and saying, look, this won't do, because your currency manipulation is actually squeezing us as well. It's going to be interesting to see which way Britain jumps here. Because the Germans and the Chinese are on one side and the Americans are on the other. And we, of course, do not use the dollar. So manipulations of the dollar are not in our interests either. But I suspect that our Tory Liberal government will be on the side of the Americans, as they usually are, whatever Britain's national interest is.
So at this G20 summit, Martin, as David Cameron reads out his speech, is this something that he has actually helped to draft? Or do his speechwriters just simply provide a little piece of paper in front of him and he just reads it out?
Well, presumably he gets to... As a prime minister, he gets to have a big input into what goes into that speech.
But he will
also be relying upon the technical advisers.
He's had a bit of a whistle-stop tour this time, and I wonder if he's actually got time to be writing these speeches. Surely, you know, happens is when he comes up to the podium, the speech is there ready for him. We had an occasion recently at a big summit in Russia where Berlusconi, the Italian leader, said, actually, the wrong speech is here, so I'm just going to talk off the cuff.
Well, that's what he tends to do anyway. And then that's the problem with Mr. Berlusconi. Signor Berlusconi, isn't it?
Apparently, it turned out to be a very good discussion, because it wasn't kind of stage managed and it wasn't written by his speechwriters.
But when you're talking about currencies and things of this sort, you've got to be very careful, because things that you say can have a huge impact on your currency.
But do you think David
currency.
Cameron really understands, when he makes a big speech like this, all of the implications? Because it is a bit ironic that he's saying we mustn't repeat the mistakes that led to the 1930s depression, when to a certain extent that's what George Osborne is doing.
Well, no. Yes, exactly. Because what Cameron means by that, we mustn't make the mistakes about protectionism and competitive devaluation. The mistakes about cutting in the middle of a crisis, that is the major mistake. And of course, they are making it. Absolutely. There are various theories about what caused the Great Depression and what the solutions would be. Competitive devaluation was a problem in the 30s, but the real problem, of course, was the orthodox financial policies being pursued across the developed world, which cut public expenditure, which is exactly what you shouldn't do in a recession. And I think we're going to find out as we're going into Christmas and the New Year why this is wrong, because the deficit will get bigger, not smaller. Bigger. And at that point, the intellectual basis for the liberal conservative policy will be exposed for what it is. There isn't one.
Now, another aspect to David Cameron's whistle-stop tour around the world, whilst riots were going on here in Britain, is this visit to China. And the Huffington Post, as one of the newspapers, has pointed out that though Cameron had previously vowed to raise human rights with his hosts, particularly in relation to the jailing of 2010 Nobel Peace Prize winner Li Xiaobo, a keynote speech at Peking University, which was one of the biggest speeches that David Cameron made there, saw the Prime Minister focusing exclusively on trade. So he didn't actually even mention human rights at all. This does seem to be a little bit concerning, because I think it's almost impossible to go to China, really, isn't it, without mentioning human rights?
Well, it depends what you want from the Chinese when you go there, doesn't it? If you're trying to persuade them to accept a quantitative easing policy from the United States, which is not in their interest, they're not likely to be well disposed towards that if you're beating them over the head about human rights. Not that I think that perhaps we shouldn't be beating them over the head about quantitative easing, and then we could perhaps raise human rights in a more realistic way. But if we're trying to bully the Chinese on the economy, they're not likely to listen to us about human rights, are they? And of course, the Chinese quite rightly say, so you're the ones who are telling us about human rights, are you, with your gulags all over the world, secret prisons, justification of torture. You're the ones engaged in wars in Afghanistan and Iraq in which millions have died. We're rather peaceable over here. You're the people with the human rights problem, not us. Now, of course, that would be self-serving of the Chinese. They do have issues, but so do we.
But there were occasions where TV crews from Britain were actually stopped from speaking to people in the street. In fact, the Chinese see opportunities, trade delegations like this, as opportunities to actually get their message out to the media in other parts of the world, because they can't through the closed media in China.
Well, that's right. And I mean, obviously, I am in favour of more freedom inside China. But then I'm in favour of more freedom in lots of places in the world. I mean, in Colombia, Afghanistan, Iraq. I mean, how much human rights do people actually have in our sphere of influence? This is what the Chinese feel, is this is all very one-sided and self-serving. We see ourselves as paragons of virtue and the Chinese as terribly backward. The Chinese say, well, look, you know, we've got a lot of problems, you've got a lot of problems. In actual fact, your human rights record looks pretty bad. And many people in Latin America, for example, would regard the human rights record of the United States government as appalling. They've supported coups in recent months in Honduras and Ecuador against the democratically elected governments. In Honduras, people are being assassinated, murdered, tortured, all with the support of the United States, indirectly. And the Chinese will say, well, who are you to tell us about human rights? Who are you? I mean, you lecture us, we'll lecture you.
Well, I'm getting deja vu now, because about 3 weeks ago, Helen Holland, the leader of the Labour group on Bristol City Council, was texting us in to say that her car had broken down on the way here, and it's quarter past, it's 16 minutes and a half past five now, and she's still not managed to make it here. So we shall press on. I'm sure she'll be here soon. She did say that she was very close by at about 5 to 5, so she must be doing about a quarter of a mile an hour or something. But anyhow, let's move on.
It's the wrong time of day.
And British Gas are to raise gas and electricity prices. British Gas to raise its gas and electricity prices, we hear today, by 7% this winter, the energy giant has announced. Now, this is just more bad news, isn't it, for family budgets. What on earth is going on here, Martin? And do you think it's actually justified for British Gas to be putting prices up by 7%?
Well, one of the things about the privatisation of the gas and electricity industries was that essentially they were privatised with monopoly power intact. And of course that was inevitable, because the kind of infrastructure you need to provide gas and electricity doesn't actually lend itself to a very competitive structure of a market, which is why all these industries were in fact in the public sector in the first place. So of course they are able to pass on cost increases that they're experiencing as price increases for their consumers. In a competitive market you simply can't do that, but this isn't a competitive market, it never was, and so whatever happens, British Gas will make a profit. And if they have to raise prices by 7% to make a profit, then that's what they will do. Whether it's in Britain's national interest to have a private monopoly like that holding us to ransom is another question entirely.
But what are we supposed to make of this? Because we've been told people right across the wages spectrum are being told, apart from the super rich, it seems, and bankers and people like that, are being told to take pay freezes, whilst some of the very basic essentials of life, like gas and electricity, it seems to me that it's possible that certainly towards the end of the winter or this winter, there may be people out there who are just literally cannot afford to heat their homes.
Well, as in Britain, there is a scandalous fact, which is that we've got the highest death from cold and hypothermia of people over the age of 65 in Western Europe, and we have had for many years. These unnecessary deaths do not happen in other European countries. Other European countries much colder than Britain, like Finland or Sweden or Norway, their old people are kept warm through the winter. Our old people often die. And that's because we are not a civilised country, and they are. And they've got a very different way of managing things. We've got used to the way we manage things here, and we think that we know what we're doing. If we look across the North Sea, we'll see that people who are very like us have got a very different way of managing things, and they do it rather better than we do. Perhaps we should take a leaf out of their book.
Now, you were saying earlier, this is one of those things which is kind of a natural monopoly. It would be a good idea maybe to go back to the old gas board, which was around after the Second World War and up until privatisation in the 1980s. But surely, I mean, there are lots of different
companies, not just British Gas, that people can buy their gas and electricity from, aren't they? They can swap around.
They can, but don't forget that the infrastructure still the infrastructure remains the same. So ultimately, there is an element of monopoly in the infrastructure, whatever you do, and that's where the choke point is. The dash for gas actually undermined the electricity companies in the privatisation structure that came out of the 1980s, and this is a fundamental fallacy that people have, that if you've got more than one company in an industry, then there's competition. And in actual fact, if you open any economics textbook, they will tell you that that is not competition, that's oligopoly. In the textbook
what
terms.
What does that mean then?
Oligopoly means a small number of large firms.
It's a cartel.
A cartel, in other words. And small numbers of large firms quite naturally tend to collude. Where they don't even have to. They don't even have to pick up the phone and talk to each other.
Well, there's a trade association.
Exactly,
but they look at
the prices that the market leader is charging, and they all follow those. Unless they're going to have a price war, which occasionally takes place. But that all that does in a price war is you force out the weaker of the bigger companies, and you've got an even smaller number of people in the oligopoly at the end of it. Now, all of this is in the economics textbook, but of course the Conservatives in the 1980s threw the economics textbook out of the window and said that competition is good, even though competition in the way they're describing it is not actually competition as it's described in an economics textbook. But hey, that doesn't matter, because some people have made an awful lot of money out of this philosophy over the last 30 years, an awful lot, even though basic economics textbooks at A level and university level basically point out that this doesn't work in the way they say, but they don't care about that.
Well, what are we to make of this, though? Because it seems that so many of the basic essential services that we need and we rely on, like things like the utilities, gas, electricity and water, it's now becoming more and more difficult to actually afford to pay for these. And I noticed we just had another circular from Bristol Water, for example, one of these magazines going right around the city, in fact, all around the region. So they seem to have enough money to put little notes through our door, but they can't give us discounts or whatever on our utility prices.
No, and of course they don't take account of social need. Basically, they're there to make a profit. That's what they're there for. And when you've got a public monopoly, you can actually force them to set their prices at cost. They don't in fact have to make more money than they need to make. They have to break even, and they have to have enough money for reinvestment. But you deliberately keep the price down, and that improves the competitiveness of your economy, and increases the consumption of the people on low incomes.
But how can the privatised version of these industries be cheaper? When first of all,
it's not cheaper.
That's why it was privatised. One of the reasons it was privatised in the first place is, but you've got shareholders to satisfy, and also you've got massive wages to pay to your senior people in that company.
Yes, and they tend to be paid a lot more in the private sector than they ever used to be paid in the public sector. I mean, a friend of ours, Adrian, you know who I mean, his father was in fact a manager in the public gas industry, and when it was privatised he became very, very rich. Good for him, but not necessarily for the rest of us.
Now, we're joined by Helen Holland, who's managed to make it here. Helen, I hope you didn't have too difficult a journey this evening.
Oh, I don't know what's happening to the traffic out there, but I'm jinxed.
So what is the council going to do about transport in the city? Because it's not just Friday evenings, is it, that there's a gridlock out there?
It isn't just Friday evenings. And I mean, I use the buses, I use the trains, but sometimes there are journeys when you just happen, you know, I needed my car earlier in the day and I came round, and you just think of all of the frustration that's building up in all of those cars where people can't get where they want to. And the thing about it is that what you need in transport is that people will put up with a certain amount, but they need some certainty. And what I didn't have tonight, I thought 3/4 of an hour was going to be adequate to get across town, and it wasn't. And that's a concern, isn't it? Because, you know, the economic, message, or the message that Bristol sends out in order to be able to attract jobs and all of those things, which are so important because of the economy at the moment, if the message is, you know, you get snarled up, that's going to be a problem.
So you're going to get a scooter?
Well, I tell you, I walk more and more and more around the city, because that's the only way you can really rely on getting where you want to in the time that you want to.
Well, yes, obviously transport is an issue for a city like Bristol at a certain... I mean, London obviously has had this problem for years, that they're actually deterring investors because people can't get around the city. And, I mean, it is. I mean, we've got lots of nice parks and so on in Bristol, but the traffic is one of the things that does deter people and makes people want to move out or move their businesses out.
So on that's certainly right. You know, when way back when I had the transport portfolio for 6 or 7 years... I could guarantee that even when I went to talk to groups about other things than transport, eventually the meeting would get round to transport. If you talk, for example, about unemployment, about skills, about, you know, why can't people in South Bristol access jobs, comes down to mobility and transport. And of course, at the moment, because of the cuts in both, you know, capital and revenue spend from the new government, the bus rapid transit that we'd got a kind of amber light on from the previous government.
Well, hasn't there been an amber light for about 15 years?
Well, not on this one.
No, this, okay. No. This is a new
plan. This is a newer plan, but we're going to be in a beauty contest with loads of other schemes with less money in the pot. We haven't got the go-ahead on that yet, and that's a problem.
What about a strategic transport authority of some kind? Because this has been mooted again and again, and it just seems that our neighbouring authorities don't like it. Is it Bath and North East Somerset and North Somerset Council or something? Why on earth might that be?
Well, I'm not absolutely certain, but it's something that certainly we in Bristol, and to be fair to the other parties, cross-party there has been support within the Bristol political groups for looking at they call them integrated transport authorities now, I think, not strategic transport authorities. But that's what we need, integrated and strategic. And we need to be able to prioritise those schemes that are really going to move a lot of people around and make the place a lot more, cleaner, nicer to be in. The city centre should not be as it is tonight. And the thing about that, of course, is that you then get more control over fares and being able to regulate the services, which is the big difference, isn't it, Martin, yeah, with what they can do in London, which at the moment, yeah, the limited powers that you have in Bristol and other metropolitan places is that you don't have those powers that you have in London.
Can I just add, we were talking earlier about monopolies and local monopolies and the problems with privatising those monopolies. I mean, in the Evening Post this week, I was reading about there's going to be the possibility of another company coming in to compete with First Bus, and this ought to solve some of the problems. And as I was saying earlier, having two companies in a market is not a competition. It's not going to solve the problem. You've actually got to there is basically a natural monopoly in a local transport infrastructure, and that's why they used to be run by the local municipalities and still are in Scandinavian countries.
And if you look at places where they have brought in limited competition, actually I think the experience is that it doesn't really benefit passengers, because what happens is they compete with each other on the best route. So you can imagine, you know, Church Road out here, yep, Gloucester Road and so on.
Yep. Two buses blocking the way.
Buses coming down trying to get, you know, nab each other's passengers. But the areas of the city where the city council already has to support those services, so evenings, Sundays, the less the less popular bits of the routes, they would be left high and dry, and the city council would potentially end up having to pick even more of the tab up.
It's quite interesting that we've got this free bus trial coming up in December. It'd be really interesting to see how that goes. This is being organised by a bunch of campaigners for public transport in the city. It's a new charitable, not-for-profit bus service. And the idea is that people subscribe, I think it's either 10 or 20 or 30 pounds to it. But anyone can actually use it for free, and that free bus trial is coming up in December.
That's also part of a campaign for free public transport in general, isn't it? It's a practical outcome of the people who've been campaigning around that issue.
And the thing is that what you see in some of the community transport organisations, there's one in my own patch, the Cat Bus, there are others in Lawrence Weston and other parts of the city, is that you do see that if people kind of have a membership of it, but then they can get to where they want to go. So for older people where there aren't service buses, being able to get to the doctors, even to the bingo, you know, those things are very important, that you see that there's a bit more, you know, there's that people feel ownership of it, and that means that they support their local bus service.
Okay, I'm just trying to find out exactly which week it is that bus service is running and where it's going from to. Maybe I'll bring you that in later on in the programme. I'd just like to get your take, Helen, though, on a story we were talking about just before you came along, which was the 7% energy price hike from British Gas's gas and electricity prices. I mean, this is something which is nothing new under the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats. It's something which was happening under Labour too. And I wonder what your solution is to this, because there are many people out there who will be thinking, crikey, I better not put the fire on this winter.
Well, it's a real problem, isn't it? And one of the things about being stuck in the traffic was I was listening to this on the radio before I got here. But you know, I understand that there are some companies who are coming out and saying that they won't have those risers. But we are really susceptible to these private companies deciding what they're going to charge. And one of the other problems about this, of course, is that the people whose budgets, whose purses and wallets are under most pressure are the least able to be able to get the cheapest prices. So those of us who can, you know, swap providers and go on the internet and find a cheaper deal, we're probably in a better position to pay if there are risers than the people who really do suffer from what they call fuel poverty. And some people think that's just a, you know, kind of trendy phrase to use, but when you talk to people, and I had an email today from a grandmother whose daughter with her small children is having to spend £8 a day on storage heaters to just heat one room in their flat because they cannot afford, there isn't proper heating in this council flat, and they can't afford to do anything other than that. When you think about what you're hearing on the benefit level caps, people just will not be able to spend £8 a day on storage heaters. And so actually being able to control energy prices for people being able to access cheaper energy is a really, really important thing.
Martin, if people, politicians, even had the political will to intervene here, we would be being told, oh, well, the government simply doesn't have the money to intervene.
Well, that's right. I mean, but that brings us back to bigger questions about how the economy is being managed and so on. I mean, we've got lots of suboptimal situations in transport and in energy. We started going on the wrong road about this about 20, 30 years ago, and we ought to actually think we used to be able to manage these things. We used to have a plan, we used to know what we were doing, and even Conservative governments knew exactly how to manage this kind of business. But we've kind of lost our marbles over a generation, and basic things which we used to know, we've kind of forgotten. And we can't go back to where we were before, because that's old, and we've got to keep going forward into more and more of the same. And we've got to break this psychology and start looking. If we look at the other ways in other countries in Northern Europe manage these things, they manage them pretty much like Britain used to do in the 1950s, and they haven't given up on those old truths. We have basically snookered ourselves now we're wondering why we can't go anywhere.
I mean, the other thing, of course, is it shows that some of these regulatory bodies are pretty toothless, really, yeah. Doesn't it? And the big issue is, of course, if the risers go through, and a lot of that money is to be able to pay senior executives, it's about private sector profits, and it's not about putting the money back into reducing fuel poverty that I talked about earlier right across the city and actually across the country.
But we just had 13 years of Labour government, Helen. I mean, surely, you know, something could have been done during that time, if anything could possibly be done. And so, you know, you don't really stand a lot of chance of getting votes in the future for that kind of thing, since we've had 13 years and nothing happened.
Well, I think, you know, I wouldn't be alone in saying that the Labour government did a lot of fantastic things. There's absolutely no doubt about that. When you look at the investment in, you know, education infrastructure, for example, all of the new schools, you look at new hospitals, all of those things. But there are some opportunities that they just didn't take. And in retrospect, I think a lot of ministers even realise that now, that they didn't bite the bullet when they could have done, especially in the early years of the 13 years, when there was an appetite for radicalism.
Yes, and I think the Condemned government now have definitely taken that to heart. They're trying to ram everything through right up front because this is their moment of opportunity. That's the way they're looking at it. Of course, they're going in the wrong direction and doing the wrong things, so that's a rather poor outcome for the country. But, I mean, that's what you have to do, and I think we missed a trick there in 1997. That was the opportunity to change the direction, and we didn't really take it.
OK, on to an international story now, and former British soldier Joe Glenton was in Bristol this week to explain why he refused to go to Afghanistan and was discharged from the army after a couple of court-martials. Friday Drive Time was there to find out what he had to say.
My name's Joe Glenton, and I'm the first British soldier to have spoken out against the war in Afghanistan. I deployed there in 2006 with a 13 Air Assault Regiment and then returned, tried to lobby for conscientious objection status, was denied, and was later jailed for publicly speaking out against the war. I'm here to try and rally people and try and make sure as many people come down on the rally on the 20th as possible, and also just to thank people for the many letters and the support I received while I was in prison, and just to kind of speak and engage with people and try and contribute something to this group in Bristol. I think the mood at the moment inside the forces is pretty much as it has been for the last several years, and they know, the guys on the ground know, that Afghanistan in their own terms is rubbish, in their own words. You know, these guys are economic conscripts. They have an economic interest, and that's it. It's not ideological, and they're just waiting until the government does what needs to be done and pulls out.
So, Martin, you were at the meeting. Can you give us an idea of what Joe was talking about and some of the experiences that led to him deciding he would not return to Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, he outlined most of what he said in his speech in that brief interview there. I think what's interesting is he is basically saying that the view on the ground amongst the British military personnel is that the war is unwinnable, and that they're waiting for it. They're waiting for somebody to recognise this and take the appropriate steps.
Did he talk about some of his experiences over there then?
Not really. I mean, he was. He's now studying politics at Leeds University, and one interesting thing he said was, I've just started studying politics at Leeds University, and I've suddenly realised that politicians are supposed to serve us. And in actual fact, all the opinion polls show that the vast majority of the British people have already decided that the war in Afghanistan is unwinnable and we don't want to be in it. But the political structure is not really representing that. I mean, there was a vote about this in Parliament not long ago, and I believe a number of Labour MPs voted against the war in Afghanistan. The Greens voted against them, but the mainstream leadership of most of the major parties is out of line with public opinion on this one.
Now, you're shaking your head there, Helen.
No, I was only shaking my head because I regret to say I hadn't picked up on this local story. I hadn't heard about it. I wasn't shaking my head because Martin's absolutely right, you know, that views are very divided on this. And I think especially at this time of the year coming up to Remembrance Sunday, that there's a difference between the support that local people feel for young men and women who are in the armed services and recognising what a horrendously difficult job that they've got, and again Martin's right on this, the overriding view of public opinion is that the sooner the forces come back from Afghanistan, then the better. And I think that what history shows is actually people have to be in charge of their own destiny, don't they? And, you know, the country needs to be supported to move to a democratic future. But sometimes you have to ask about at what cost that is.
Now, we've heard also this week from the veteran Jewish American scholar Noam Chomsky that he believes the US-led war in Afghanistan is actually criminal. This was reported by Iranian news service Press TV. And they say Noam Chomsky says the US invasion of Afghanistan was illegal, since to date there's no evidence that al-Qaeda has carried out the 9/11 attacks. The explicit and declared motive of the Afghanistan war was to compel the Taliban, says Mr. Chomsky, to turn over to the United Nations the people who they accused of having been involved in World Trade Center and Pentagon terrorist acts. The Taliban, they requested evidence, and the Bush administration refused to provide any. The 81-year-old senior academic made the remarks on Press TV's programme A Simple Question. We later discovered one of the reasons why they did not bring evidence. they did not have any. The political analyst also said the non-existence of such evidence was confirmed by the FBI 8 months later. The head of the FBI, after the most intense international investigation in history, informed the press that the FBI believed that the plot may have been hatched in Afghanistan, was probably implemented in the United Arab Emirates and Germany. Noam Chomsky added that 3 weeks into the war, a British officer announced that the US and Britain would continue bombing until the people of Afghanistan overthrew the Taliban, and that was later turned into the official justification for the war. All of this, he says, was totally illegal. It was more criminal, said Noam Chomsky. Now, how significant is it, this American Jewish academic coming out with these thoughts about the criminality of a US-led Afghan war, Martin?
Well, Noam Chomsky's not actually made a statement of this kind before. I mean, many people listening may not know who he is, but he's a major critic of US foreign policy and has been for many years.
He's at Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Yes, and he's also an expert on linguistics. He's a linguistics professor. I think what he's pointing out, the FBI, in fact, have said that they've never had any evidence that Al-Qaeda carried out the attack. That's been true all along, but you wouldn't think so from looking at the mainstream media. Ahmadinejad spoke at the United Nations a few weeks ago, if you remember, saying that the Iranians are not so sure that the story as told by the Americans is actually what actually happened, as has General Ivashov, who was the commander of the Russian armed forces on the day. Now, our media basically don't go and delve into these areas very, very deeply. But the point I made when Joe Glenton was speaking earlier in the week in the Malcolm X Centre was that in the 1980s, it's beyond doubt that the British intelligence services, the CIA, were involved with setting up Al-Qaeda, training them, providing them with weaponry, mostly Soviet bloc weaponry from Israel, and they were funded by heroin trafficking, all of which is documented, and there is no doubt that that's what was going on. What they seem to be saying to us is, well, we did have a relationship with all of these terrorists at one stage, but then they suddenly went out of our control. Robert Gates, who's the current US Defense Secretary, was the head of the CIA during Operation Cyclone, and I suspect that if he was given a bit of waterboarding, we might find out what's been really going on. But I don't think that's going to happen.
Actually, don't know if you really think that, Marty, do you? Because you're totally against torture.
Yes.
Anyway, Helen, what are your thoughts about this US academic and what he has to say about the war here? Because it is a bit cheeky, isn't it, saying you're going in to find bin Laden and then once you're in there, a few months later, swapping your reason to be there and saying, actually, we were always after the Taliban.
Well, I mean, that's one of the problems, isn't it, that people always seek to, justify the unjustifiable. And it's interesting, isn't it, that in the week when George Bush's autobiography has come out, certainly reading the excerpts that I'm sure other people have read in the national press, trying to kind of get behind how some of these people in very significant and no doubt about, the stress and the international spotlight being on President of the US, obviously, many would say the most powerful position on earth, but to try and understand the motivation and what was actually going on in their heads when they decided to do what they decided.
Okay, and also, I mean, you mentioned Remembrance Sunday earlier, Helen, and we've heard this week that Muslim protesters have burned a poppy and chanted British soldiers burn in hell during the 2 minutes of silence in London earlier this week. Dozens of protesters calling themselves Muslims against Crusaders were saying British troops are murderers, there will be no security for Britain while troops remain in Muslim lands. What are your thoughts, maybe, Martin? You want to go first on this, on this kind of statements being...
Well, I mean, what we know is that groups like Al-Majhroun, which are not Muslims against Crusaders, but a similar kind of group. I was an aid worker in Bosnia in the 90s, and we knew for a fact that MI6 were using these extremist groups to recruit young British boys to fight in the Bosnian War. So there's strong linkages between these Muslim extremist groups and our own security services. MI6 was the lead agency for recruiting the Islamic International Brigades to fight in Afghanistan during the 1980s.
But are you actually saying then that Muslims don't believe that these troops will go to hell?
Most Muslims will be absolutely horrified by the behaviour of these people. And I'm just suggesting, who are these people? Because we know that these kind of groups in the past had very strong links with our own security services. In the 1980s, Britain's MI6 were the lead agency for recruiting Islamic extremists to fight in Afghanistan. That is why, in Melanie Phillips' phrase, we've got Londonistan in London. Most of these groups were based in London. You know why? Because MI6 was the lead agency for recruiting these people. Are these people still working for MI6? That's the sort of question that I ask myself. I was, of course, absolutely condemn what they're doing. Of course I'm opposed to the war that's going on in Afghanistan, as opposed as they are. But if people are remembering the dead of two world wars in quiet silence, this is not an appropriate way to protest.
The problem with... I agree with Martin on one thing, and that's that most Muslims, certainly most Muslims that I meet who live in Bristol, work in Bristol, want to be part of Bristol, would absolutely condemn what's been said. There's absolutely no question about that. The other problem with this is that the people who want to believe that there's a kind of Muslim plot, you know, to make the UK into a Muslim state, those kind of thoughts that are whipped up by right-wing fascist groups, they alight on something like this, and the problem is it's given far more oxygen than actually it deserves, because what we need to hear is Muslims condemning that, and they do.
They have, I'm sure.
And they have, yes. I'm not saying that they haven't, but unfortunately these stories get a life of their own, don't they? And they're repeated in the right wing and the tabloid press, and people then come up with all of their own sort of spins on those stories.
But if
and
Muslims,
that's very, very unfortunate.
But if Muslims or Christians or Jews believe that someone is going to burn in hell for their deeds, should they not express that?
Tony, what happened with the police handled this rather well, I think. They were allowed to do what they wanted to do. The English Defence League then tried to attack them. They were prevented from doing so. And the police basically defended the right of these Muslim demonstrators to do what they were doing, although they are to be condemned by any serious people, but of course they're entitled to do it if that's what they want. I question who these people are. That's what I question, because there is actually an agenda here to create and demonise Muslims, and they are playing that into that game.
I was away last weekend with some other Labour group leaders in other parts of the country, including Bradford, where, as you remember, the English Defence League wanted to march. And what you heard from the story from the leader of Bradford Council was about how it was ordinary people sending the message, you are not welcome here. It's not about huge amounts of policing, important though that is, if you actually get a march of these people through your place. But what people need to do is to say, we won't stand for this. We don't want them to come here. These people are not representing the views of ordinary Bristolians.
Right, well, let's move on from that and have a listen now to Marina Morris's Vox Pops for this week. And Marina's been out on the streets asking you which way you voted and what you think of the Labour Party, especially for Helen.
Which way did you vote in the last local council elections?
I voted for Labour. I'm a working man. I firmly believe they are the political party which represents me.
I voted for Labour because I am a long-time Labour supporter. I believe that they have the best interests at heart for the everyday person. I think that Conservatives are for the rich and Liberal Democrats make policies that they can never put into practice.
If I told you, I'd probably get shot. Seriously, yeah, but not Labour, no, anything. But if I told you, I would seriously, I'd probably get hung and strung.
Liberal Democrat, basically, and I was disappointed when he decided to pally up with the Tories, so I shan't be going down that avenue again, basically.
I think I voted Lib Dem. Do you know what, I'm not all that political, but they just seemed like the less of two evils.
Conservative, because I always have been. They get it right more often than Labour.
Liberal Democrats, wasn't really much choice, to be honest. They're the only people who are going to get in, so no point voting for anybody else.
I voted for the Lib Dems, because they seem to have like the most policies that made sense to me.
Liberal. Just a halfway house, really. Didn't really know who to vote for, so went sort of halfway.
Labour. I guess there's just still a belief with me that at some point Labour will return to its socialist roots. So I'm going to dig in there and carry on voting for them. Because I think, realistically, they're the only viable challenge to the other two parties, main parties, so that's probably why.
What did Labour do wrong to lose control of Bristol City Council?
I firmly believe that somewhere down the line, Labour lost the plot. I think that they forgot what, as a political party, they actually stood for and who had got them into power over the last few years. I firmly believe, in my opinion, that somewhere down the line, they forgot about the working man.
I don't think Liberal Democrats do enough to keep hold of the council, so I guess people in Bristol who vote don't read enough into who they're voting for.
What they did wrong to what they did right, if anything, I can't see any different. I've got no faith in Labour whatsoever.
You just have to look at their spending habits, and I would never think of voting Labour, really.
They micromanaged a bit too much, and they didn't really give the normal people like enough control over their own lives.
What do Labour have to do to get Bristol back?
I think they have to think about the working class people. They have to gain people's trust and confidence again, and they have to come up with some damn good ideas to persuade those people that voted away from Labour this time to go back to them. And I believe they can do that.
I think they need to focus on public transport. I think that's a really, really big issue in Bristol that isn't being addressed by the Liberal Democrats. And I think that is where Labour could steal some voters.
I suppose be more eco-friendly. Bristol's a very eco-city. I suppose it's all about that, isn't it, really? Get a lot of people on board and stop there being so many Tescos.
I think they probably have to be a lot more left-wing with their policies, really. Kind of have a not-so-new Labour, more old Labour approach to things.
In my opinion, I would say you need to address housing. You need to have affordable housing. You need to look at the kind of housing that you're creating and who you're gearing that towards. It's certainly not people that... It's going to be people that are professional, that are on quite high salaries. So they need to look at housing. They need more social housing, maybe safety, travelling, traffic. That's another issue. For me, that was the main thing, the housing.
So we hear there's some suggestions for you, Helen. One is housing, the other is transport. Have you got any good ideas?
Well, I think, yes, certainly we have got some good ideas, which we're developing at the moment. And I'm not, unfortunately for you, going to reveal them all on tonight's show, but I'll certainly come back when we launch our manifesto process for next year and talk to you about that. But I think one of the, it was a mixed bag of messages, wasn't it? And I think what you hear, there are diehard Labour people who will carry on voting Labour through thick and thin. There are people who have voted Lib Dem and have been disappointed by them going in and propping the Tories up nationally. And there are people who wouldn't vote Labour, if hell froze over, sort of thing. So the thing is about how do we win the confidence back? And I think there's some truth in what people said there about and any party that's in control, either of the country or of the council, they're bound to, by the very nature of it, almost sort of lose touch with individuals. And Labour mustn't do that. And a period of being out of control has meant we've been back working with communities, talking to people and listening to people's ideas. And it's really interesting to hear that your thing, public transport and traffic, people being in charge of what goes on in their own communities, community safety, housing, green issues, all of those ones are pretty much the same things that are coming up in the work that we're doing, developing our pledges for next year. So watch this space, really.
Okay, Martin, what did you think of what you heard there? Because there was a couple of people talking about Labour having lost touch with its roots.
Well, I mean, that's a fairly common view amongst a certain section of the electorate, a section of the electorate that's been rather frustrated over a generation. I think we need not think in terms of old or new Labour, but we need to start thinking outside the box. I was pleased to see during the election campaign for the Labour leadership that Blairites, if you like Andy Burnham, were talking about things like land value taxation. Ed Balls was talking about building more council houses, and I just saw a glimmer there of perhaps we ought to be thinking outside the box of spending cuts, outside the box of the financial orthodoxy. And it wasn't just coming from the left of the party, this was coming from people who are quite in the centre of the party. And I think as we go forward into what is probably going to be a much worse economic crisis than any of us have ever experienced, that having solid radical ideas to sell to the electorate are going to be important. And obviously on this programme we do our best to try and tease some of those out.
Yes, but it's all very good having the ideas, but when you haven't got the money to actually afford them.
Well, the money is the issue about how you manage the economy. 1% of the population of Britain owns 50% of the wealth. 50%, 1%. The bottom 50% of Britain's population have 6% of the wealth, and that's concentrated at the top end. So perhaps 30 to 40% of British people have no wealth at all. Now, that is the situation, and that it can't be allowed to continue indefinitely. Sometime, if we're in a national emergency, those with the money are going to have to pony up.
Now, Helen, I know that we're having an extra £20 million worth of cuts here in Bristol. So what's your Labour group's reaction to this? I mean, this is the Lib Dems on the City Council who run the City Council who are imposing this £20 million. Surely, if you're in power, you'd just have to do the same.
No, we wouldn't. I think, you know, that's one of the differences, that it's been very clear from what Ed Miliband and the Alan Johnson have been saying, that, yes, there was a deficit reduction plan that we had. But one of the things that was absolutely at the heart of that was not making cuts that undermine the ability of the economy to pick up again. And that's what we're in real danger of seeing now. And this thing about the extra 20 million, I mean, it really does have to worry you, doesn't it? That the Lib Dems in the council house don't seem to know what level of cuts it is that's going to be visited on us. But we know that what they've decided to do is to front load those cuts. In other words, about half of the cuts that are needed are going to come out in the first year, which is, because of the speed that's going to happen, is bound to be some rather sort of, you know, quick wins, if you like, things that we can take out that nobody's going to notice, that they are, you know, non-statutory services, all of those things, without actually sitting and thinking about what it is that Bristol City Council needs to be doing to be supporting the Bristol economy. And I think that the speed and the depth of these cuts coming from the Conservatives and Lib Dems in the coalition nationally, seems that the Lib Dems locally aren't doing anything to fight against that level.
Yeah,
of
but a lot of the restructuring of the City Council, for example, some of the statutory services that have been being carried out by charities and voluntary groups, that sort of thing, all happened actually under a Labour administration here in Bristol and in nationally. So, you know, surely, you know, your party's culpable for this. Well, we're in a situation now where a lot of these charities are actually finding it really difficult to get money. You know, the National Lottery are sending a lot of their cash for the Olympics, and a lot of the services which used to be council statutory services are just crumbling.
I think there are two separate things here. Supporting the council being able to deliver services is not the same as just saying that you are going to try and protect every job in the local authority. Although obviously that would be a good thing, you know, people don't want to see that job losses to the extent that these cuts are going to inflict on us. But actually, picking up one of your vox pops earlier about people being in control of their own communities, actually giving community organisations, charitable and voluntary sector organisations, the wherewithal for sustainable budgets that mean that they can deliver services, those services are sometimes better than the ones that the council gives, because those organisations have grown out of communities and they reflect the needs of the communities, and all of the communities across Bristol are different. And so I think that, you know, it shouldn't be an either or. We should be thinking, working out what services do we need in Bristol, and then working out who the most appropriate people are to deliver that. And I support the voluntary and community sector, because I know that often those services have really grown up from the grassroots, and they really do serve the people that they, you know, they are designed by.
But now, to a large extent, a lot of these voluntary community sector groups are taking the blame, aren't they, for something which used to be something which the City Council ran.
Well, I don't think so, because what needs to happen there is that the City Council needs to be clear about its monitoring arrangements. So if a community group, for example, is delivering care for people with learning disabilities, and they've agreed that they're going to, you know, run activities for a certain number of people on a certain number of days of the week, then we need to make sure that our money, which is, you know, council tax money that's been collected by all of us, from all of us, is being used properly. Because obviously there is no point the City Council saying we won't do this anymore because there are groups out there who can do it for us, if we're giving them the money and people aren't getting the services. But the feedback on a lot of those services is that local people really, really value those services because they understand how that service is being delivered, which quite often in the city council people would feel it's such a huge monolithic organisation. They get passed from pillar to post around the council and they don't really know why, you know, what has shaped those services.
Okay, well, we're nearly coming up to the end of the first hour. Martin, I'd just like to pick up on one thing. Joe Glenton mentioned the former soldier, mentioned a rally on the 20th. What was all that about? What's happening on the 20th?
This will be probably one of the many rallies that have been against the war in Afghanistan. We had Andrew Murray on, who's a chair of Stop the War at the meeting, and he said some of you will have been to some of them, some of you will have been to all of them.
This is up in London, is it?
Yeah. And there will be buses if you email bristolstopwar.co.uk, you can find out details of the demonstration on the 20th.
Okay, well, thank you very much to this week's guest. I managed to get in eventually through the traffic. Helen Holland, leader of the Labour Group and councillor for Whitchurch Park. After the news, the students.
It is your voice and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol